You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Occupy Radio.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, Friday, September 19th through the 21st, at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. The goals of this Cascade Media Convergence are to create a space for media makers to network and share best practices, collectively learn skills, and lay the framework for continued collaboration and plant the seeds toward building a regional grassroots media coalition. There will be workshops, strategy sessions, and space and time for deeper discussions on all aspects of grassroots media. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, September 19th through 21st, at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle Productions premiere of Tick, Tick, Boom, a play by Jonathan Larson. Tick, Tick, Boom is a three-chapter pop-rock musical about facing crossroads in life and holding on to your dreams that was first produced off-Broadway in 2001. Tick, Tick, Boom plays at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland, from September 4th through the 27th. More information about Tick, Tick, Boom can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Occupy Radio. We are here on the third anniversary of the Occupy movement. September 17th, 2011 was when everything kicked off in Manhattan on Wall Street. And today we are going to be talking with a member of Dignity Village. We're going to be talking with Margaret. She was nice enough to invite me into her home and talk about her experience at Dignity Village, what it means to her. We're also going to go to Occupy Radio, that's produced by the Occupy Eugene Media Group, and our friends Rivera Sun and Getch. They're going to be talking with local PSU professor and one of my colleagues, Tom Hastings, and also Ann Metter and her observation on citizen journalism. We're going to go to that now. I'm here at Dignity Village, and I'm talking with Margaret.
Margaret Smolock, yes.
Margaret Smolock.
Yes.
And
Structure 11.
Structure 11. Margaret has invited me inside her home, and I came out today. I don't know if you had a chance to hear the last show that I did. I talked with Paul and Kimberly, who were some of the newer,
right,
almost brand spanking new, yep, members. And I was just kind of touching base with them. And what I'm trying to do is talk about what it means, not just to have a place over your, a roof over your head, but a place that's yours. Not just this little building that we're in right now, but kind of this bigger community and what it's meant to you to be part of that community. And how long have you been living here?
A little over a year and a half. And it is a good place to call home. I mean, it's a safe place from the streets. That's how you got to look at that one, you know. And because there are people that do get harassed out there on the streets by the cops and stuff because they have nowhere to go. So I'm glad that the city found the land for us to be here, you know.
What do you think about the way that Dignity Village operates?
It's improving. It's still got a long ways to go. I mean, Rome wasn't built in a day, you know. It's got a long ways to go still.
When you say it's improving, like what are the improvements that you've kind of seen?
The NAAA meetings are going good. There's absolutely zero tolerance to that. You know, we've had to let a few people go because of their constant drinking. So that's how I mean by it's improving. And, you know, it's just in the long run, I mean, Nancy's worked wonders since she started off as the secretary. And now that she's running it as the CEO, she's just, you know, you can only do so much. So, you know, she's doing good for what she, and then she's got Paula as the treasurer. I think it's because the women are in the office, you know, because you got Tina now doing secretarial stuff, and it's improving, you know, it's getting better.
And what's your take on sort of the idea that the residents are sort of running the place? What do you think about that?
I like the idea for one because it's you know, a lot of people like the government, they sit in their fancy homes and then they want to build these other little model homes, you know. You don't know unless you've been there, you know. I like the fact that it's self-governed. And, you know, it's a nice little place that, yeah, I can call it home because it's where I reside at the end of the day, you know. And like I said, I've been over here a little over a year and a half, and when I came here, I was recovering from an auto accident I was in. So I could barely, you know, walk, talk, and, you know, stuff was going on in my head. My jaw was swollen. My shoulder was swollen. I could wobble, but not real good, you know.
Did that auto accident kind of lead to you losing your home?
My not only my home, it cost me my job as well.
What have you done since you've been here at Dignityville? Like, what is your role kind of in this community?
I'm security coordinator. I'm one of the security coordinators. JD's the other one. And I make sure that, you know, there's no fights breaking out or any, you know.
What sort of tools or tricks of the trade do you use to sort of make that happen? What's your approach to that?
Most of the time, it's funny because most people just want to be heard. Whether it's a bad day, good day, you know, they need to de-stress just like everybody else. It's how you approach them.
Give me an idea of how you do that.
Someone needs to vent. They want to scream and yell. All right, let's go for a walk. You can yell at me all you want, as long as nobody else has to hear it. And that's how I do it.
And that you kind of use that to sort of diffuse the emotion?
Diffuse the situation before anything bigger gets out of hand, you know?
And how do you feel that, like, as a community, the rest of the people here, how do they sort of feel about, like, the idea that y'all run your own security and that you have these rules and this? How does that, what's your sense of how people sort of feel about that whole notion? And like you said earlier about this being a safe place, like, what does that mean to people?
It makes them happy to know that they're not, that they can sleep through the night and not have to worry about, well, not only the police, but whatever else is out there at night, you know? I mean, I've gotten up one night and seen a coyote right out here on the other side of the fence. So it scared me, but, you know, I knew I was safe, so.
And I'm also curious, like, when you've been working with people, say maybe somebody who's having a little bit tough time and maybe they're having some trouble sort of regulating themselves and keeping themselves chilled out and stuff, like, we could just call the cops and let the cops take care of it, but you all don't necessarily do that.
We kind of do. They do. We do have a relationship with the Portland police. And if anything gets that escalated, yes, we do call. But for the most part, I mean, the whole community, the village, has been coming together within the last couple of months and realizing, okay, we gotta stop yelling at each other if we're gonna make this work on the inside, for the people to pass the word on the outside that this place is getting better and safer. It's one of those things that we gotta work together on. So.
And you feel like it's going well as far as working together?
Yes, that's where I say it's got a lot more improving to do, but right now it's doing great. I mean, we really haven't had at the last council meeting, no IRs were written on anybody, so security had nothing to report.
And IRs are incident reports, and
yes.
What type of things would you write one?
Theft, drugs, alcohol, harming to oneself or others, that kind of the five basic rules.
Is there anything that you would want to say to a larger audience of people about this place and why it should remain and why it's successful and why people should really even care to support something like this?
It's important because if you don't support something like this, and you've seen, what was it, Channel 2 News that had the ones that they wanted to build that cost thousands of dollars, they're wasting money, man. They should put it here and make this thing improve a lot more. Because we need, I'd say, one of these in every major city throughout the United States, because homeless just isn't here. It's all over.
Sort of the Dignity Village model places in each city.
Yeah.
So you're an advocate for expanding that.
Yes, I am.
How do you think the, I guess, collective wisdom that's here at Dignity Village about doing that, how do you think that could be sort of used to make expanding this model successful?
We got to get the word out to the right people. Too many people have heard the wrong kind of thing, so they get the wrong idea. It's a matter of getting the word out to the right people. The right word out to the right people, I guess you could say.
That was Margaret. She is a resident of Dignity Village here in Portland, the original tiny homes movement. Everyone here in the city of Portland should be proud to know that we're leading the charge on providing effective, efficient, and affordable housing to people who would otherwise not have somewhere to call home. For the next and final extended segment of the show, we're going to go to Occupy Radio out of Occupy Eugene Media Group. Getch and Rivera Sun be talking with local PSU professor Tom Hastings, a colleague of mine on the Portland Peace Team and also Peace Voice. And also we're going to hear from Ann Metter and her thoughts on local citizen journalism. So we'll go to that now.
Tom Hastings is a professor at Portland State University in the Conflict Studies Department. He is also a senior editor at Peace Voice, a program of the Oregon Peace Institute. He is the founder of the White Feather Peace House in Portland, Oregon, and a former Plowshares resistor, as well as the author of several books on nonviolence and many, many articles.
Tom, I want to thank you for coming on Occupy Radio today, and it's going to be a pleasure to find out about the Peace Voice program.
Well, thank you very kindly for the invitation.
Yeah, I think, Tom, that is a great project to start off talking about. I mean, when I met you at the James Lawson Institute, I was just very impressed by the breadth of your life experience in the field of nonviolent struggles and working for peace. But before we dive into everything that you might have done in your life, maybe we can start with this current project, Peace Voice. What is it and where did it come from?
Yeah, well, the problem for me was that my so-called colleagues in the peace scholarship world did not really get out there and explain to the American public that back in 2002 and early 2003, that in fact, we all knew that Saddam had no weapons of mass destruction. We all knew that he was not cavorting with terrorists. We knew that this planned invasion of Iraq was based on two huge lies. And yet, very few of us found our way into the national conversation. It's always an uphill struggle to do that. And so I was just very frustrated that we were unable to sort of break through the barriers to be able to be heard by average Americans and to say, you know what, the average European knows all of this stuff. The average person in the peace movement knows all this stuff, and you need to know all this stuff. You need to be aware of this and make an informed decision. So I thought about it. We lost our struggle to stop that invasion, and I just thought, how are we going to fix this in the future? And so I created this service, basically turned to the peace intellectual community and said, I want you to become public intellectuals. Public peace intellectuals, not just publish pieces in the academic journals so that you can continue to get promoted at your universities, but engage. Engage in our national discussion. And I was inspired by a little snippet in the film Bringing Down a Dictator, where some activists in Serbia started going around and getting stories in local newspapers that offset the lack of their ability to break into state-controlled television and state-controlled newspapers back in Belgrade. And they actually entered enough of these small markets and mid-sized markets to affect the national conversation, to change the public discourse. And I thought, now, okay, that's a pretty interesting model. That sounds like a lot of work. It sounds like people power, and so let's see if we can build this. So that's what I started to do, and it took a while to figure it out, and we're still working on figuring it out more. But what we do is students have volunteered, and they've helped me over the years. It's really been sort of up and running for about 7 years, and they gather contacts, mostly email addresses for editors of small town, mid-sized market newspapers, periodicals, etc. And so I've got a database of those people, and I've got also a database of peace intellectuals, peace, justice, environmental protection, anything that falls under the rubric of positive peace, which is basically peace, justice, environmental protection by peaceable means. And I solicit these pieces, they write them, and now I've got an editor, a very talented young woman who is also an alum of the James Lawson Institute, the first one last year, and her name is Erin Niemela, and she actually has gone out and improved us substantially. So what we do is we get these op-eds, and then we send them out to all of these editors, almost 4,000 of them, coast to coast, and every single piece that we send out gets picked up by several places. So we are entering the conversation in small town America, you know, along the Gulf Coast in West Virginia, out in the Sierra Mountains, all of these small markets. And occasionally we get in bigger markets like the Madison Cap Times or the Detroit News, etc. But mostly it's small town America, whose normal news sources are Fox News. And we give them oftentimes the first glimpse of something else. So that's what our goal is to increasingly enter into this sort of flow of ideas in where they live. I lived for 25 years in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, and I know what it is to raise unusual issues like peace and justice issues, environmental protection issues, in the middle of chainsaw and gun country. That's where I lived, and that's where I worked, and those are the people, really, I want to talk to, and so that's what this is all about.
This is a good connection to our most recent show where we talked about Gaza, not so much because of Gaza, but because one of our guests raised the specter of the U.S. media bubble that we all live in, where we don't know what's going on in the rest of the world because what we learn from our media is so tightly controlled. And it sounds to me like this is an attempt to break through that media bubble. But one of the things I'm curious, you're talking about you have op-eds and they're about positive stories of peace, I think is what you said. I wonder if you could frame the information that you're putting out just a little bit more for our listeners. What is the message that you're bringing to these journals?
Sure. Yeah, well, first of all, I appealed to the Peace and Justice Studies Association, which is the academic association of a bunch of peace studies professors. And so I get maybe an editorial one day on domestic violence. The next day I'll get one on don't bomb Gaza. The next day I'll get one on alternatives to, well, a year ago it was alternatives to attacking Syria. Now it's an alternative to militarily attacking the Syrian rebels, the ISIS. You know, so it's a really wide arc, all kinds of stories on climate justice, the Keystone Pipeline. It's a big arc. So whatever is on the minds and whatever is in the news, we try to channel alternative views into mainstream media. Although some of the alternative media digests and sources are in our distribution list and thus use our pieces, like our pieces that will appear on Truth Out and Common Dreams and the Huffington Post and so forth, but they are not our primary targets. Our effort is to do what one of my students said years ago, which really was part of my inspiration. She said, I used to teach a class called War, Peace, and Media, and then I've taught a class called Peace Journalism. And I can't remember in which class she said this, but it was brilliant. She said to another student who had been complaining endlessly about corporate media, she said, if you don't like the way you were manipulated by mainstream media, then learn how to manipulate mainstream media.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, that's the mass audience. We really understand these issues very, very well by tuning into alternative media. And we need to take that knowledge and break it into the mainstream media. And it's uphill all the way. And yet, you know, uphill struggle is, if we don't just look at the mountain and say, oh, we could never do that, we say, well, let's start figuring out how we're going to climb that mountain.
Does that influence the ways in which you ask your contributors to write articles, like in terms of language changing or approach to explaining a situation to an audience that maybe isn't rooted in the peace and justice dialect, so to speak?
That's a great question. Yeah, we basically will get in there and I'll edit with a meat axe if I have to. And I will send a piece back and say, you know, your exhortation was great, but here's what's going to sell in basically Heber Springs, Arkansas. You've got to do exactly what you said. You have to translate your language into basically Americans want to play fair. Americans do want justice. So you can't go in there with all this sort of either left-wing or kumbaya language and say, this is how you should all think. Instead, it's like, present the issue in just plain talk, you know, rather than, that's the other translation, of course, is from academies, from the multisyllabic Latinate down into good old, you know, monosyllabic Anglo-Saxon 1-2-3 language that the media analysts tell us that is the average reader across the United States. You need to do something that can be understood by somebody with maybe a 6th or 8th grade education. And that's not being condescending, that's being real. That's talking to people where they are at.
Last fall, we had Susan Strong on the show, and I think she's the founder of the Metaphor Project, and she wrote a book, which I don't remember the name, it's something like Speaking American, and that's the concept that if you want to reach through this media bubble, reach out to the, you know, mainstream America, you have to speak in terms that, you know, all of us Americans understand, and, you know, in symbols and language that we're most comfortable with. And it sounds like that's what you're exhorting your writers to do.
Exactly. Yeah. You've got to speak to people so that you don't alienate them coming right out of the gate.
Yeah. Do you incorporate pop culture and such into that? It seems to me that that's really the key, is if you want to, you know, get there inside their bubble, you got to get with the things that are already actively inside that bubble.
Yeah, and looking at the research, so for example, Nicholas Kristof did a column some years ago where he cited some research into who we are sympathetic toward, what kind of victims of injustice or victims of violence, or who are the people that we are most likely to want to protect. And it turns out that this is just about universal. Do not do anything to little girls. And if you hear about an injustice where a little girl is a victim, then bring that to any people, not just the American people, any people, anywhere. And the average person is going to respond with sympathy toward your argument. How can we protect children, and in particular, little girls? That's just what the research says. And Kristof said, well, he and his wife have worked quite a bit in Africa to basically bring about a stronger set of rights for girls. And that's where the strength lies in gaining sympathy with people all over the world.
Tom, have you seen a shift in people's approach to war and media over the time that you've been putting together and launching Peace Voice?
Well, we continue to gain more entrance into more small town medias, newspapers, basically. So that tells me that editors want what their readers want to read about. So more and more of them are becoming open to this. I think part of it goes to other research, which talks about war weariness and ripeness for peace. And of course, after all these years of, you know, ever since 9/11, and well, a month after 9/11, we've been at war. I mean, actively at war, never mind the, you know, little military missions that are sort of always going on, but big war. And the American public is weary of that. So it's the time to really pursue this. It's the time to say there are alternatives that people really realize. I mean, you can't find an American family that doesn't have some connection to one of these god-awful wars. And you can't find an American town that doesn't have, you know, a lot of tragedy coming back into it from these god-awful wars. And I have so many students who have either been in combat or their spouse has been in combat, their brother, et cetera, et cetera. So we're to that point where there's a real receptivity to alternatives. That was very hard to do in the early days of these wars because of the giant impact of 9/11. But now I think all of us are hearing much more sort of readiness to engage. And we won't get there by saying, you stupid soldiers should have never signed up. We get there by approaching them as, you know, this is a bad idea. You know that because you've been in combat. You know that because you're suffering from all of this still. You know that because you've seen this god-awful war from the inside, or your family has, or you've seen how your brother came back. You saw what happened to your husband when he returned.
It sounds like you guys are taking the lessons of the 60s and bringing them into our day and age, because as you pointed out, sort of obliquely, I think, but in the 60s, we didn't embrace the returning damaged soldiers who really had no choice but to, you know, either be punished for acting in accord with their conscience or submitting to military service. And now you're seeing these people who are coming back as resources to help build the momentum of the peace movement.
Well, I'm going to agree with you on one level, and then I'm going to challenge that a little bit on another level.
Oh, please do.
We've got this sort of cultural myth that we called the returning soldiers in the 60s baby killers and spit on them and so forth. And that's really been debunked. And I can tell you, as a working class kid, literally working construction and, you know, having basically 99% of my friends and relationships were with other working class young guys, many of whom were freshly returned from Vietnam. Almost 100% of them were anti-war, and we got along great. And I was a conscientious objector. And this is my experience, is that I never saw that sort of mistreatment. You know, maybe I was in a bubble in my hometown in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but we never had that issue. And in fact, in the peace movement back then, just as in the peace movement now, when we marched down the street, the first people in line carrying their banners were the, in those days, it was the Vietnam Vets Against War. And nowadays it's Iraq or, you know, whatever other veterans. We are led by the returning combat people. In my experience, and my brother-in-law was in active combat in Vietnam, came back, and ultimately, a few years later, was declared an Agent Orange victim. He got cancer and died, and I literally lifted him onto his deathbed and became aware through other struggles and through his struggles of just how profound the level of mistreatment of our veterans was from our own government. So that's the mistreatment. They came back and they were mistreated, but not by the public and certainly not by the peace movement. They were mistreated by the same people who sent them to war, by the government itself.
That has a long historic trend in the United States, too, and has fueled several anti-war, pro-peace movements throughout our history that are often, like this particular example, glossed over in our concept of who we are as a people.
Yeah. I was in a correspondence with one of my buddies who, he was from Minnesota, but I never met him until he came back from Vietnam. All of his letters were signed Peace, Love, and Skag, and Skag was the nickname for heroin. I mean, it was a culture where, I mean, and I had another friend who came back, and his claim to fame was that he had painted the largest peace sign on any naval ship in the Cameron Bay. I mean, you had a culture within the military of this war sucks, and it was, you know, not as profound during the Iraq War in particular because the excuse of I was drafted was taken away. So you didn't have the same sort of, you know, push of resistance from basically people who were legally required to participate in the conscription, you know, or involuntary servitude. As we all know, it was basically a poverty draft. And if you looked at the, you know, the list of ways that the government, particularly during the most furious part of the Iraq War, the way that the government avoided having a draft, they did more draft resistance than the peace movement. I mean, they were doing everything from stop loss to increasing death benefits all the way up to practically everything except for guaranteeing, you know, paradise with 69 virgins or something. It was just like the methods that the government was using to avoid having conscription were pretty spectacular during the most furious part of the war in Iraq. And they knew that you have a draft, you have conscription for an unjust war, and you're going to wind up with huge resistance from inside the military. They didn't have it quite so much this time around because they were able to succeed in avoiding the draft by all of their means, not the least of which was to basically go into poor neighborhoods and recruit like mad. Also, they here in Oregon, they were even recruiting people with profound learning disabilities, people who were, like, you know, 1 point above the legal definition of, you know, mentally disabled, and they would be just doing anything to get warm bodies with guns to avoid having conscription.
Which I think we could tie into the world we live in today, especially in light of what we've seen in Ferguson, but what we know has been going on behind the scenes and away from cameras all over the country. You're talking about how they're trying to do everything they can to avoid a new draft. And the reason for that is because that will create a backlash and the peace movement will flourish within the military. But it seems to me that in a sort of a reverse sense, we've all been drafted into this military world now that our police forces have been militarized and the standard police response is one of overwhelming force, whereas it used to be more crisis resolution and now it's more crisis expansion.
Instigation.
There you go.
I And we'll be back hearing more from Tom Hastings after we take a quick break. And also a new guest for our alternative journalism section of Occupy Radio.
You're listening to Occupy Radio, streaming at kwvaradio.org and podcasting at occupythemedia.podomatic.com. I'm your host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe. Here we are with our second local alternative journalist coming on to Occupy Radio. This week, it's Ann Metter, most recently of the DC Media Group. And Ann, I've been following your work, especially in these post-Ferguson days, and very impressed with what I'm seeing. And I'm very excited to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you, David. It's good to be here.
And as you often tell me, there's always something going on in DC, but maybe you could share with our listeners some of the key issues that you've been focusing on lately.
Well, there's really been probably two main things I would like to focus on. A big thing, of course, is Ferguson. There's been a whole lot of solidarity with Ferguson, Missouri, in Washington, D.C. Several events, several big vigils and protests in solidarity with Ferguson. I'm just amazed at the emotion that's been provoked by the events there, by the shooting of Michael Brown, and by the protests themselves and the grief, and especially the response to those protests, the militarization of the police, and the fact that they have not yet arrested Officer Darren Wilson.
And what do you think, Anne? Is Darren Wilson ever going to get arrested?
Well, you know, there's a grand jury out considering that. I really couldn't say because, you know, if we had a really just justice system, he'd already be arrested. This is down to prosecutorial discretion. And, you know, if McCulloch was exercising any good discretion, I think Officer Wilson would already be arrested.
Yeah, it's just a sad track record, though, that it's difficult to get your, I don't want to say get your hopes up, but to just expect that it'll have that kind of resolution. But like I said, I have been really, you know, drawn to your coverage of Ferguson. And one of the things I'm curious about in D.C., what has been the police response to the sympathy protests in D.C.?
It's been pretty mild. In general, in Washington, D.C., very well trained on First Amendment protests because there are so many of them.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a regular occurrence. So they're they do roll out a lot of police, and we're very accustomed to seeing particularly ones, protests that groups that they find threatening, say, anarchists or World Bank protests or protests for immigrant rights, anything like that. They'll really roll out the armory for that. You'll see the paddy wagons, the dogs, the tear gas canisters. You'll see there are tons of agencies, DHS and Secret Service and God knows what else in Washington. So you see that, a lot of armament. On the White House roof, there are snipers, of course. But in general, they keep it low-key, which is a way to handle protesters. I mean, if they had any sense, they would have dealt with protesters in Ferguson that way in the first place. It's just terrible optics in the first place to roll out all this stuff. You know, that's just number one, if you want to get into that. So these have been pretty low-key. You know, they put out plenty of officers, but it's, you know, a pretty low-key response.
Would you say that with the solidarity protests happening in D.C., are they growing at this point, or are they kind of stabilizing out at the same intensity of what's going on in terms of the arc of those efforts?
There have been several vigils and protests in solidarity with Ferguson. I would say there have been three that have been very large. One was in Malcolm X Park very soon after the shooting. The last two Saturday nights have been, just the energy has been amazing. About 1,000 people Saturday before last, the 23rd, they were about 1,000 people out in Chinatown, shut down the place for over an hour. This was organized by several groups, including the National Black United Front. Last Saturday, there were a few hundred that shut down U Street, and they started at Union Station and went up to U Street. They marched for 3 hours. long time to be out in the street. They got a lot of crowd solidarity in the neighborhood, you know, honking, waving from cars and passersby. The energy is just amazing. I mean, for an event that the shooting, a tragic event that happened almost 3 weeks ago, or almost 4 weeks, I think. You know, the anger, the grief, the energy, the resolve on the streets is really amazing.
Do you feel like, you know, when Occupy started, it took a little while before people realized something had started? And I think we all recognize that it had its arc, and I'm not saying that it's past tense, but it had its arc, and we're waiting on a new arc to pick up and run. And do you feel like the anti-police militarization, the hands up, don't shoot meme is poised to really move people in large numbers across the nation?
Well, last summer, after the George Zimmerman verdict last July in 2013, there was a similar upwelling of grief in D.C., a lot of marching. It really seemed like there was a spark, you know, another tragic event, but I felt hopeful that this was going to really energize the African American community to, you know, force some changes, that it would really energize some activism and leadership from that community from the bottom up. And that sort of seemed to die out, and I was a little bit disappointed. But, you know, that rage, that anger has been under the surface, not surprisingly. And that's all come out in Ferguson, I think. And I think this is going to be much more sustained. So even if it lasts only a few months, you know, the real climax of it, the real on-the-streets, visible protests, we're going to see a lot more action, a lot of more people involved in a continuing activism to change things. You know, as we saw with Occupy, you know, Occupy changed us very much so. And, you know, a lot of us never really left Occupy after it ended, because we just couldn't go back to the way it was before. And I suspect this is going to be the way it is for a lot of people who have been affected by the protests in Ferguson, that they see that getting angry, getting out on the streets has changed them, that they can never go back, and they must go out and change the world. They will never be able to tolerate these police and the tanks on the street, the assault weapons. They will not be able to tolerate their brothers and sisters being gunned down on the street by white police officers. It's just not acceptable anymore. And if that doesn't change, they're not going to go back to their homes peacefully.
You know, until there's some real substantial change that goes on, the situation is always a tinderbox waiting to ignite. Every shooting that occurs, we've seen this building up over this year, that, you know, when Eric Garner was strangled to death, that built an outcry. Then when Mike Brown was shot, then, you know, every time we have an assault on a black person by police officers, it grows. I think that one interesting angle this time is that with the reveal of the militarized police to a level that we haven't seen since the Boston bomber, which was framed very differently by the media, which I thought was very unfortunate at the time, because it's a disturbing issue, not a patriotic issue. But now we have communities across the country concerned about that as well. So I think we have actually kind of two smoldering tinderboxes going on, and that's actually quite useful for building the momentum of a change movement. But Anne, before we leave today, I would like to ask you to speak a little bit about what's going on in Cove Point, because I know you've also been working very hard on stopping that fracked natural gas export terminal. Maybe you could give us a brief update about what's going on down there.
Thanks, Rivera. I'd love to talk about this because I love to let people know about this really important issue. Cove Point is now a natural gas, or a liquefied natural gas import terminal in Southern Maryland, and its owners, Dominion Energy, is trying to convert this into an export terminal for liquefied natural gas. Its importance is that it would be a major exit point for natural gas from the Marcellus Shale. And it would incentivize a lot of fracking from the Marcellus Shale. The Marcellus Shale is a rock formation from New York through Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and parts of Maryland and Virginia. Fracking has really been a devastating practice, and it's devastated a lot of parts of the country through contaminating water supplies, making people really sick. The fracking, you know, we have a really bad drought in California, and they're still trying to frack out there, and each fracking well takes at least 1 million gallons of water. So you're talking about major depletion of aquifers and water supplies, contamination of water supplies, and they're trying to say, oh, this doesn't hurt anything. So they're trying to export natural gas now and make a whole lot of money off of it. This is the big plan. And Cove Point, if it's approved, would be one of the exit points for this natural gas. It's on the only one that would be on the Mid-Atlantic, so it's very advantageous for the natural gas companies to get the gas out of the Marcellus Shale. Now, this is a very critical time for it because we're waiting on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to announce its decision about the permit for Cove Point. We're expecting it any day now. It could be today, tomorrow, next week. Probably a very high probability that it's going to be a yes for Cove Point, unfortunately. And that would be the biggest hurdle for it to start construction. There's a likelihood of lawsuits challenging it. We've also had an interesting law ruling in the last few weeks. The Board of County Commissioners in Calvert County carved out a zoning exemption for Cove Point. They said essentially that we're going to exempt all LNG import and export facilities from our zoning laws. Well, guess how many import and export facilities are in Calvert County?
I'm guessing one.
Yeah, I mean, there's only one in the Mid-Atlantic, one import facility in the Mid-Atlantic, not to mention Calvert County. Unfortunately, the Board of County Commissioners in Calvert County
are bought and sold.
Yeah, they're just a little stereotype of the most Yahoo corrupt entity, local government you could imagine. I hate to say that because I love Calvert County. I have ties there, and it's a beautiful place with wonderful people. But this local government has been corrupt to the core, and an export facility there is essentially placing a bomb in the middle of a community. LNG is highly explosive, highly volatile. Mm-hmm. And there would be about 700,000 cubic meters of LNG stored in 7 tanks there, with a probability of accidents like a vapor cloud. There's only 130 acres site footprint, and they have to build an entire power plant to power the whole thing. They have to build what's called a liquefaction train to supercool the natural gas to be able to load it onto the tankers. And it just happens that the only empty space within this 130 acres is right next to the front gate.
So that'll put it closest to the public, the surrounding residents?
Right. I mean, there's a street in front of the front gate, and then there are houses across the street. Mm.
They're in a blow-up zone, basically.
Right.
Well, Anne, we're going to have to come back to this issue in a little while when you get that ruling and the efforts to stop it in other ways ramp up. But I want to tell our listeners that we're talking with Anne Metter, who is the co-founder of the DC Media Group and a writer and citizen journalist. And Anne, if you just briefly want to give people something to think about before you sign off, then that'd be great.
First of all, I would love for people to get more educated about fracking, because this is going to be a big issue for us in the future. Natural gas and fracking is not the way that we need to go for our energy policy. We need to go for renewables. So please, in your state, in your area, make sure that it's not supporting fracking or the use of natural gas.
That might be in your home. Thank you so much, Anne, for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks.
We're back with Tom Hastings of Peace Voice, and we're talking about nonviolent peace teams and how they can be used to encourage nonviolent activism. you had that article about your peace teams, and I wonder if we could explore that concept and how peace teams can work to interface with a population which is growing increasingly traumatized by the military presence in our streets.
So I've found as I've gotten older that I tend to be attracted to the work that will be of service to various campaigns and movements rather than getting involved in every issue myself. And this sort of hyper-activist mode that a lot of good activists go through is like, this today I'm going to go to this for climate this, and tomorrow I'm going to go to this for the militarization of police or, you know, whatever. There's just no end to the specific issues. So my two main sort of volunteer things these days are Peace Voice, which we just talked about, and the peace teams. And the peace team, from my standpoint, is there to both help create and protect and defend the image of movements and campaigns as appealing, nonviolent, and basically to assist those campaigns and movements in their efforts to recruit. Because a peace team will go out and try to make sure that the behavior code that the organizers are explicitly asking for is maintained by the participants who show up. Participants show up for demonstrations and they haven't gone through, a lot of them have not gone through, for example, nonviolence training. And it's very easy to provoke them because they come to the streets because they're angry about something, and rightly so. So they're easy to provoke. And when they do get provoked, sometimes the media will see them and record them doing things that are very alienating to the public. So the peace team, what we do then is try to maintain a level of civil discourse so that that image is not sort of tarnished, so that the average person who's watching it on television or reading about it in the newspaper will not look at that movement and say, oh my God, that's scary, I don't want to join them. You know, I agree with some of what they say, but I'm not going to risk that. So the object is to lower the barriers to recruitment and to enable those good campaigns and movements to continue to increase their numbers by not being alienating. If we do find behavior that is persistent and violates the code of behavior that the organizers have called for, then we try to make sure that the public ultimately knows that that person or those, that group of people doing this alienating behavior were not with the movement in question. That they came out into the streets and did their own thing, that they are a separate and unconnected, either an individual or a group.
Okay. I had mistaken the purpose of the peace teams. I had seen the peace teams working, say, in Ferguson, between the protesters and the cops to find common ground. But what you're saying is focus on your own camp and make sure that everybody is being held and holding themselves to a similar standard.
Well, no, you're right. We also do police liaison work or liaison training. And that's a very valuable part, and it's all toward the same goal in the end. But in other words, if a movement isn't in communication with the police, then there's a big danger that the police are going to be afraid of that movement, and they're going to come out high, hard, and heavy, and somebody's going to get hurt. The images of somebody getting hurt will go out into the media, and that will alienate the public and make them not only afraid to join in, but a lot of them will be, you know, grateful for that thin blue line that protects them from the very demonstrators who are in the streets calling for an end to the violence. So to the extent that the movement wants it, we do both media liaison work and police liaison work.
Great. How would a movement or a campaign access the resources of a peace team or maybe even build one of their own?
Well, I think going to the Shanti Sena Network on Facebook is a good start. The sort of original peace team in the United States was 20-some years ago. They started one in Michigan called the Michigan Peace Team. It's now, in the last year, they changed their name to the Meta Peace Team. But there are now a string of peace teams across the United States. And I think going to that to that connection in Facebook, but I also think that the MetaPeace team in Michigan has got a nice website, and they've got training materials. There's no reason that somebody could not start a peace team in their own town. I think that the training manual at the MetaPeace team website is a very good one. We used it in Portland to help start our peace team here, and then we actually found the resources to bring in several of the Meta trainers. And last March, we did a big training. Almost 100 people showed up, and they sent, I think, 4 trainers, and we did an 8-hour training. So that was the sort of boost up for our Portland peace team.
I noticed when I was going to check in the Peace Voice that I guess you're part of the Peace Collaborative Development Network?
Yeah, that's a huge network now, 30,000 peace professionals and students. And so we're connected to them, but so are
30,000 other people.
Yeah. But it was a brilliant innovation by Craig Zelizer, who's a professor, I believe, at George Mason. And this thing has, I've watched it grow over the last few years from, you know, just a couple hundred maybe peace professors up to, like I said, 30,000 some people involved from the whole arc of the nonprofit world, the humanitarian aid world, the statecraft world, just lots and lots of huge range of discussions on that network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does look like an amazing resource, and one, Rivera, that I definitely think you and I should plug into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since we are another resource for peace.
You can sign up free for their newsletter. The only thing is you got to be ready to get a lot of emails. They don't have a digest service yet.
Well, okay, I guess that's what filtering's for.
Tom, I wanted to ask you a little bit, just to do a little disambiguation between peace teams and international unarmed peacekeeping forces. And I kind of guess that you know something about that too. But I was wondering if you could help clarify the distinction between those two for anyone who might be combining them in their mind.
Well, they're related. The Nonviolent Peace Force actually helped to start the peace team network in the United States. And what happened was Nonviolent Peace Force informed the MetaPeace Center in California that it would no longer be able to be the coordinating body for the peace teams in the United States, that it was going to focus on, as you say, the international work of unarmed peace teams that it had been doing in places like Colombia and Sri Lanka, the Philippines, etc. So when Nonviolent Peace Force informed the Meta Center of this, as it happens, the director of the Meta Center is a former student of mine, and she contacted me and said, so Nonviolent Peace Force is no longer able to coordinate this, and the Meta Peace Center would be happy to do this, but we don't have any particular connection yet, and we need for this to be, you know, we need to meet. So can we come and meet in your peace house in Portland? And I said, of course. So representatives from several of the peace teams in the United States came and met for 3 days at the peace house I live in, called White Feather in Portland. And basically I was just the cook, and, you know, people were sleeping all over the house. And so they decided to form this Shanti Sena network. And it's now, you know, kind of up and running. And so it is, in fact, you know, sort of a spinoff from this international work. The international work requires much more training. The domestic work, we basically will put people in the, you know, in the front lines. We work in teams of at least 2, preferably 3 or 4, and we will do a 2-hour training, and somebody can take the field with us. Obviously, we keep them in a team with experienced people, but the international work takes a lot more training. Obviously, the cultural aspects, the language aspects are, you know, much more complex.
And they're generally going into violent conflict zones, am I correct?
Yeah, you know, and I think, as Getch mentioned, the militarization of American police, we are finding ourselves in some militarized situations too, but it's nothing like what you just talked about. I mean, when you go into Mindanao and the Philippines, and there's been guerrilla warfare going on for decades, that is, as you rightly say, quite a bit more challenging than our domestic work.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we are talking with Tom Hastings, who is a professor at Portland State University teaching conflict resolution. And he's also senior editor at Peace Voice, a project of the Oregon Peace Institute. And Tom, I want to thank you for coming on the show today.
Well, Well, I would just like to thank you for all the work that you are doing. I think that to the extent we understand that nonviolent sort of transformation of any conflict is possible. We can't necessarily always see the possibilities right in front of us, but they are there. And the research shows this more and more and more. This is really great research that's being done, and that's what we're finding out, that our efforts are actually working.
Great. And I mean, it's wonderful to keep reinforcing that message with people to not give up on nonviolence, to try it at least as long as we've been trying violence on this planet, which has been 10,000 or plus years. And thank you, Tom, so much for sharing your knowledge of resources that are out there for people to plug into and keep aware of.
Thank you, Rivera, very much, and Getch, and carry on with your outstanding work.
You can find out more about Tom Hastings by visiting his blog at hastingsonnonviolence.blogspot.com. You can find out more about Peace Voice at peacevoice.info, and the Oregon Peace Institute is at orpeace.us. The Peace Collaborative Development Network, or PCDN, is at internationalpeaceandconflict.org. You can read Ann Meter's reporting on Ferguson and other stories at dcmediagroup.us. You can also find Ann's work on Truthout, and that is truth-out.org. You're listening to Occupy Radio, which is part of Occupy the Media. And you know, Occupy the Media is the name of a podcast series, but it's also a mission statement.
Because in the age of corporate media, reporting the truth becomes an act of resistance.
Occupy Radio is one of six excellent Occupy and social justice related shows you can find every week
at occupythemedia.podomatic.com.
Occupy the Media!
Nathan Stevens is our producer, and we have support from OEMG, the Occupy Eugene Media Group.
Thanks this week to our guests, Tom Hastings and Ann Metter, and thanks to my wonderful co-host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
Hey, Occupiers, we'd love to hear from you, and you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line at OccupyRadio23 on Twitter and Gmail. We're Occupy Radio on Stitcher and iTunes, and we're looking for those lovely five-star reviews. You can find us on Facebook on the Occupy Radio group page, and we are occupyradio.org.
For Occupy Radio, I'm Rivera Sun.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Home Skillet Movie World Premiere, combining a character-driven narrative